Yeah, especially in that city. Who knows?
Charlie and Nancy were going around.
Who knows what political intel was all of a sudden available. Okay, good morning, everyone. Welcome to this work session on our comprehensive plan. We are going to walk through this morning really the groundwork for the rest of the process over the next several months. So we're going to try to make sure that all of us, as the ultimate adopters of this plan, are up to speed on what the process is, on what the big issues are, and how and when we will address them. So this is really more of a groundwork setting work session than an issue exploration work session, though we'll do some of that today. So with that, let me ask Susan to kick this off and
take it away.
Great. Good morning, Mayor, Council. Susan Anderson, Director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. And with me here are my team, Joe Zender, Chief Planner, Eric Engstrom, Tom Armstrong, and Deborah Stein. I want to start, I think, by thanking you all for all of the time that you've already put in and all the attention over the past few months. We've had many meetings with you individually and many with your staff to talk about many of the issues. And you've waded through documents and maps and letters and emails, and you've all played around on the map app. So you've all learned a lot. And you've all listened a lot. I think it was about 14 hours of testimony that you've heard on the plan so far. And that's been, from residents and businesses who, of course, are caring about individual properties, but also very much caring about their neighborhoods and about their communities and about the place they want Portland to be over the next 20 years. So thank you for listening, and thank you for diving into the issues and beginning to really understand many of the places. We know that Portland's changing, and this plan represents our best effort to get ready for those changes. As you've heard before, over the next 20 years, we anticipate about 250,000 more people and 140,000 more jobs. The comprehensive plan, again, is a tool, a very important tool that we use to manage this growth and also to reach our many housing, employment, environmental quality, affordability, transportation, and other goals. Our past comp plan has served us well. It's why one of the many reasons of why so many people want to be in Portland now. We're known worldwide for planning and sustainability efforts, and now we're at the point to finally adopt a new plan. And that plan recognizes that we are a different community than we were 35 years ago when we adopted the first one. We are a much more diverse community, and we hope this plan will serve the next generation of Portlanders. So, as you know, this process has been going on for some time. I'm going to walk you through. I can actually see the light at the end of the tunnel now. Let me now walk you through kind of where we've been and where we're going over the next couple of months. So the Planning and Sustainability Commission spent about 3 years developing the draft. They then had almost a year of hearings and work sessions on the document that was starting in the summer of 2014 through summer of 2015. They collected more than 4,000 comments during that time, and the result then was to integrate those comments into the recommended plan that the Planning and Sustainability Commission forwarded to you in August. After you received that plan, then you held a series of workshops in September and October around this table here. That allowed you all to really immerse yourselves in the issues and begin to discover what the primary decisions are that you are going to need to make over the next couple of months. Then in November, December, and January, you held 5 hearings on the recommended plan, and you collected a lot more public testimony. That testimony came in many forms. You'll remember it all at the verbal testimony at the hearings, but then also through emails, letters, and the MAP app. And we found that the MAP app has been a great tool for increasing the amount of testimony that came from not the usual suspects. So other people that may have never come to a public meeting felt very comfortable in their own living room or in their office turning on the MAP app and being a part of the process. So we see that as a good success. In total, about 2,000 more comments came in since we've had the council's public process. So that's kind of where we've been. To get us to the final plan, we have scheduled four work sessions with you all. This is the first one today. Two more in February, and then the last one on March 1st. Hopefully that will be sufficient to get us there. We will use these sessions to answer your questions. We'll have staff available to encourage your discussion and debate on various issues, and to let you introduce specific amendments that you already have in mind. So we'll begin to have that discussion so we don't wait until the very end to pull all the amendments out on the table. We'd like to get as many of those out early on. And then we hope to have on April 14th, middle of April, another public hearing on those amendments, and then you get to vote. So hopefully that's in May, but we'll see where you end up. So that's kind of where we've been, the process, and where we are now. Questions?
I have a question, just to set the expectations going forward. So we've been at this for a while, and my sense now is that there are some really big, complicated issues we're going to have to resolve, where there is some pretty clear fault lines in the community, and so we're going to have to, as a group, wrestle with those. There are some second-tier issues. And then there's the potential for a flood of amendments that are related to the testimony we've heard or the emails we get in our offices or the meetings we've had with people. And it would just be helpful for me in going through to make sure I understand clearly what your role is and what our role is. And in particular, to the extent there are some big picture issues where we may need legal guidance or policy guidance, including in areas where your commission may have a different view than staff has, how will we get that information through this process as a complement to the work we'll be doing about the specific issues we want to know more about or the special pleading we'll be doing for people that have contacted us individually?
Always your role is to tell us what to do, so that's our difference in our roles. But predominantly our role is to line up the issues that we've heard, both from the Planning and Sustainability Commission, from all of the public, and any staff points of view, and to lay that out for you in a way that'll help you make your decisions. So we're going to try to put them in buckets, more or less, of here's the top 20 or 25 big issues where there is a little bit of difference or a major difference of opinion in the community, and put those out on the table, you know, early, so that you understand what those are. And it, as part of that decision-making, laying out where the Planning Commission actually had come out on that decision, and then any differences of opinion that because of new information, if there's new information that's come to light in the interim, we want to bring that to you. So I think that's our role.
But Susan, do you feel fully empowered to the extent we get into an issue where either you at the senior staff level, the legal department, or someone thinks that we're outside of our lane generally in terms of what we're discussing, are you going to be throwing the red flag out and saying, hey, here's what the debate is, but we want to tell you we think there's a line here. We got to make sure we don't cross that line.
Yeah, I think that's my job. My job is, I think, amongst many other things, is to make sure that you are getting the best information, both from what we call the community wisdom, but also from the technical knowledge that we have and what's going on in other cities. And we want to make sure that you have that knowledge. It's not our job to make the decision, but we want to get the best information in front of you.
But I appreciate you starting that line of questions. Let's walk a little further into that, because I think it's important that we not only know how the process is going to work between us and the staff that Susan has ready to help us, but also among the five of us, so that we're not surprising each other and so that we can bring ideas forward. And I think we ought to talk about both schedule and process there. I have some amendments in mind. I don't have them all fully baked. I will get them baked and get them to the table. I know you do as well, Commissioner Fritz. Others might be working on them. If there ought to be, you know, a heads-up process in which, you know, let's take a big picture issue. I mean, the big picture issues tuning issues and details. I mean, it's sort of a big picture issue. We don't have design review in anywhere near as much as the city, so we should have design review in more of the city. Here's my amendment about that. That's a big picture issue. Then there's a tuning issue. Well, why are we still allowing drive-throughs in mixed-use zones? I don't want to do that. Let's eliminate drive-throughs. Then there's details. This person came in and made a great case about that piece of property, and I think that they are right, and we should change the map from this zoning designation to that zoning designation for that particular homeowner, property owner, whoever. So I think each of us, it's highly likely that each of us has amendment ideas in each of those, on each of those tiers. And again, mine are formative. I've got some that are fairly clear in my mind and others that I want to spend more time on over the next few weeks. Let's talk about, and maybe you already have some suggestions about how we, in a orderly and transparent way to the public, say, okay, here's Commissioner Fish's amendments about this. The council's got them under discussion. They're going to be on the docket for testimony at this point. So on the back to the classic 85th percentile rule, the Planning Commission and the staff have gotten this document to the 85th percentile plus or minus 5%. We do the rest. How?
Yeah, and I think part of it is that we've had sort of an off-Broadway kind of look at how to get there with the Planning and Sustainability Commission, because they went through the same thing, that there were big policy issues, and then there were all the way down to issues around particular properties. Eric has sort of the system that we're using.
Yeah, one of the agenda items today was to talk about the agendas for the subsequent work sessions, and I think that relates very deeply to what you just brought up. So I'm going to jump ahead and maybe go further in describing that before we have a broader discussion. On the back side of your agenda for today is a tentative work session agenda list, and a couple things to note on that list. What we are trying to do is organize the time we have with you to have those big picture, I think as you described, where there may be fault lines that you have to weigh in on and have that discussion as a group. There are going to be a lot of other smaller amendments that may not need to have that level of discussion, but you still want to make them. And so one role we can play as staff, and we put this as a tentative idea, but we've been trying to collect our lists of what each of you are interested in. And so one thought is that if we can serve as a collector of those ideas and get some kind of consolidated list of all the things that you may be interested in amendments, albeit a preliminary list, over the next week, so that we can then have mutual awareness of what the different interests are. Because we've all talked to you one-on-one, we have a sense of that, and we've put together this tentative agenda for your subsequent work sessions based on some of those themes that we think are in those discussions. And as Susan mentioned, it's a little bit buckets, and so any one of these buckets may have a number of specific amendments that relate to a broader theme. And so the idea is that within each of these agendas, we can go one bucket at a time and disclose what some of the related amendments might be, have the central discussion. You give us some broad direction. We're not voting in these work sessions, but you give us enough broad direction to work with each office to finish up the language on the amendments so that we can bring that back and then have a document eventually that represents the collection of the different amendments that have come forward.
Well, I have to say, I really like the idea of publishing a preliminary list. And one of the things it allows us to do is go through our own lists, and to the extent that it turns out Commissioner Fritz is the champion or has signaled she's going to work on that issue, it's just one less issue that we'll take responsibility for. So I think just in terms, because a lot of the more motivated people out there didn't just go to one office to make their case. So knowing who is the most motivated and who's likely to bring an amendment, I think that's helpful just for good order. Giving you a chance to review them and be prepared to then give us real feedback. And let me just be very clear about my expectations. If I put an amendment out and Susan, your team looks at it and you decide that it is legally the wrong, as a matter of law, it doesn't belong in the comp plan for X reason, or B, you think it's ill-conceived because it's inconsistent with the drift of the comp plan or some other policy, or three, you think it actually is a good idea but should be parked somewhere else and not the comp plan. That's the kind of feedback I hope we get from staff. even if at the end of the day the council overrides you and legal. But I want to make sure that all that's daylit so that I have a clear sense of what risks we're taking on if we do get close to that water's edge.
The other thing I'd mention about this proposed agenda is there are going to be individual minor map or policy amendments that don't rise to the level of needing a lot of discussion. They'll be fairly clear to anyone who reads them and where there aren't staff concerns. And so having that preliminary list allows us to sort a little bit and identify the ones that are fairly easy. We also have a list on the map side. Staff has sifted through a lot of the comments, and there are a number of requested map changes that are just based on new information that maybe the Planning Commission didn't have that affect one small line on the map that isn't going to rise to the level of a big issue. So we're prepared to make a recommendation, and I think our list right now has 50-some very small items on it that just clean up and are generally consistent with the Planning and Sustainability Commission's direction to you, but they just didn't have that testimony at the time. Examples would be properties that are coming forward to say they have a split zoning situation that they'd like to remedy. We would have remedied it at the Planning Commission had we been aware. So again, we have a whole bunch of minor things like that that came up in testimony that were compelling to us that we'll put forward as a staff list of minor corrections that we think you can broadly look at and say this is okay and consistent, a consent list, if you will.
There's one topic that I don't see on this list, which maybe it's not a separate topic for a separate day or just something we need to weave in throughout the discussions, but the anti-displacement agenda isn't called out as such.
The closest to that is the March 1st community benefit discussion, and that could be broadened to be the broader package of that. That's one of the policies that...
That's something to check in with each of us about, and that is any other topical areas where, looking at this list, I see areas where I know I'm going to be interested in considering amendments. Like I said, design and mixed use is one of them. Transportation is another. You've got those topics, but the question is, are there other omissions? Are there other omissions like that that people say, oh, wait a minute, and make sure we talk about
it. And it might help if I just run down what we meant by some of these
to
start you off, and then I'll get out of the way and you talk. So today we did propose later in today's agenda to take on two substantive issues that we're prepared to do. One is about the public involvement policies. Another is about the employment opportunities analysis and the commodity forecast issue. I think you're mostly aware of what that involves. Next week, our proposal was to start at the broad mapping level and look at that concept map where we have different kinds of places and centers and corridors on the map and just take a little bit of time to review that. And there may be some amendments related to how we've designated different places at a broad level. The second item there is a fairly broad topic, but it's design and related policy, particularly around mixed-use development. You had a lot of testimony of various flavors on that. And so we would be prepared to talk through some of those. I think it could be an aspect of the design review question that you mentioned as part of that. We got a lot of testimony in favor of a thing called the Division Design Initiative that we ought to look at and relates to mixed-use development from that community's perspective. So there's a couple things we could bring to the table there. Middle housing, a number of you have expressed interest in the testimony about the question of middle housing, and that's what we mean by that is the housing that is of a scale that's larger than single family but not as big as the larger apartment buildings that we're seeing. So examples would be attached houses or duplexes or triplexes or fourplexes, kind of the generally wood frame, smaller scale but not single family. There's been interest in exploring that topic. Although today we have the commodity forecast, which is central to the employment land issue, there are some individual employment-related mapping questions, and I think that's a topic in itself to explore those different questions. You got a lot of testimony about the golf courses, for example, and there are a number of other individual employment-related map changes that we heard about and that may make sense. And so having a section devoted to that. Nonconforming uses in small commercial nodes, this is the issue of all over Portland, we have small, isolated lots where there might be a corner store that's been there for a long time, but it's been zoned residential for a long time, and that kind of goes back to what I guess would be the Euclidean zoning period of Portland, where we were trying to force commercial out of neighborhoods. And I think that this new comp plan, one of the principles here is to have commercial within walking distance of everyone. And so those isolated nodes we may no longer not want those to go away. And so looking at how we've zoned those small isolated stores or cafes is something we want to talk about. And that is one where there's a fault line, that there's two competing theories about what the right decision is there. We left some time after that for us to present the thing I mentioned before, which is we have a list of small-scale map changes that are corrections, and we think it would be good to go over that and just talk that through. There are transportation strategy and policy issues that you ought to talk about. You got testimony, quite a bit of testimony about Chapter 9, which is the transportation policy chapter, both about parking and about... there's a policy called the transportation strategy, which generated a lot of pro and con testimony, and so that's worth discussing. Transportation projects. Remember that this plan has three parts. It has the land use map, the policies, and the project list. And we don't get that many comments on the sewer and water system. I guess maybe because it's underground and it's harder for people to understand. But we do get a lot of comments on the transportation system, and we did believe transportation staff and Commissioner Novick have looked through potential project list amendments related to transportation, and that we ought to talk about those. We can broaden the community benefit topic to broader about the anti-displacement package as a whole. The community benefit agreement policy is one, to your point, Commissioner Fish, that has generated attorney and administrative interest within the city bureaus as well. So. Working through what the right language is and what's the right way to say things and still be in bounds to what the comp plan is supposed to be about is core to that topic, I think. We heard a lot about historic preservation, especially in the last hearing or last two hearings, and what the relationship is between those policies and the zoning and how we deal with communities that are historic but also have a mix of densities. So that's another topic. And then we left some slots at the end for other things that we need to talk about, because they'll probably be small 5-minute items that we just need to have some daylight with all of you. And again, there below the surface here, there will be lists that you all can make, and some of those items will just not be controversial. You may not have to talk about them in council, but you need to eventually vote on whether you want to accept those amendments and why you're making that change.
So let me ask a question about where something falls, and that is council spent a great deal of time recently talking about accessory dwelling units, but there are still ideas and proposals respect to those, respect to tiny houses, respect to other innovative housing forms and types smaller than middle housing. Is that when we would want to do that, probably take that on early in February?
Yeah, that's logical. I would also mention that, again, that these work sessions, the intent is you're not voting in these work sessions. You're giving us broad direction to go finish up specific policy amendments. We would target March 9th for trying to compile a complete list of all the amendments with the actual text and maps. And what that allows us to do is publish it ahead of time so people can read it before the hearing. But also it allows us to send notice to those property owners that maybe the map wasn't affecting them before, but now it is because of an amendment. It would be good for us to notify them, and that allows that time to do that. And then the April 14th hearing is what you continued the hearing to when you last met. And so we have to meet then, and the intent is that that hearing is about the amendments. You eventually have to do the more parliamentary procedures of actually accepting or not the amendments and then doing a final vote, and that would presumably happen after the April 14th hearing at a time that you select.
Well, I think realistically, we've set that one date and time for a public hearing on amendments. Given our experience thus far in the process, I suspect that won't be the only one.
It might
one.
Be continued, yes.
Yeah. So so I might want to go ahead and start working with Carla and block out some space. It doesn't have to be evening. but the next couple of Wednesdays and Thursdays after that to make sure that there's adequate time, because both in our own discussion and action on amendments and in hearing from people in their reactions to the amendments proposed, one hearing, I can safely predict one hearing won't do it.
There's also a factor that once you actually kind of reach a decision, staff needs a little bit of time to work with the city attorney to finalize the findings, because when we make a land use decision, we have to make findings of fact, and that might take us a month or so. So there may be a month gap of just us working with the attorneys to finalize the ordinance and the findings, and then to come back to you for acceptance.
Just like to clarify, although these are work sessions and we won't be taking public testimony, I'm sure people will be watching at home on Portland Community Media, and that they'll be running it multiple times. So certainly from me, if there's been some discussion and we've completely missed the point, I'm more than happy to hear from constituents and community members with comments, even during the work sessions, even though there won't be public testimony.
You have an option here, so we have about an hour, and we have two issues we want to get into, which are looking at the public process that we have in public engagement and public involvement policies, and then looking at the Portland Harbor and the commodity. Before we do that, though, in the spirit of getting from here down to the plan, we've talked to your offices, and we do have the beginnings of a list from all of you. But if you did have any remarks you wanted to say now, or anything about sort of your general observations from all the testimony and everything that we've gotten so far, sort of in the manner that the mayor's just said, that there are some things that are missing here, we'd love to hear any of that early and often. Otherwise we can dive into some of the topics.
I can elaborate a little more thematically on what I said earlier, and again, I'll be getting much more specific over the next couple weeks. But as always, I think that the staff and the Planning and Sustainability Commission have done a great job, and they've gotten the plan to somewhere in that 85th percentile. I think there are a number of areas in which I would like us to consider being bolder and more directive than the plan is today. One is in how these mixed-use zones that are substituting for a combination of storefront commercial and auto-oriented zones in our old comp plan, how they're really going to work, how walkable they're really going to be, as opposed to sort of enshrining an older pattern of development. Second issue that I've spent a great deal of time already with Commissioner Novick and transportation staff, and that is I believe we need to get very specific about the kind of urbanism that we want to create out of places that are now not urban, and that includes street plans and policies for how people divide large parcels into urban development, i.e. if it's a five-acre dead Kmart with a lot of asphalt out front, it should not be a five-acre site with a private development on it when all said and done if it's in a mixed-use zone. So how do we take places like 82nd Avenue or other areas where the pattern was very auto-oriented, large parcels, not walkable? How do we both add a lot of value to those property owners? We're in some cases making people wealthy over their objections as we make that kind of change. But how do we add a lot of value, but also make sure that it's the kind of development that 50 years from now people will say, boy, they got that right when all that change happened in Portland under that comp plan? So I want to lean farther in that direction, and I'm looking at specific both policy and other amendments there. Another area that's of concern to me is I think we've not gone as far in terms of historic preservation as we should as a community, and where in the comp plan should we be more serious about that? And then finally, I've already heard some map issues that I think are have merit. And there are others, again, where I think we can be a little bolder maybe than the first draft was in terms of what do we really want this part of the city to be. Maybe the market's not there now. How do we set that area up for the kind of redevelopment that gets us the neighborhood that people want in that area, even if it doesn't happen for 15 or 20 years? So those are just some big picture concerns I have. Moving more aggressively away from the automobile, being specific about what kind of development pattern we want, not just with colors on the map, and then being more more serious about preserving historic fabric than we perhaps have been. Those are three big themes for me.
I have an even longer general observation that I want to make, and it relates actually particularly to middle housing, but it goes a bit beyond that. But I'm going to outline why that's an issue of particular concern to me. As you've heard me say, and I think this is true of all of us, that we need to work to see how we can best accommodate all the people who are projected to move to Portland in the next 20 years. As I said in the last forum, to a great extent, we should welcome more people moving in because greater density allows for living patterns where people can avoid the car. It makes transit more viable. It sets up situations where people have a grocery store they can walk to if there's enough people within walking distance of the grocery store. But another reason to allow for more housing and a greater variety of housing is housing affordability. And I think that we need to figure out how we have greater density in a way that allows for a pretty wide variety of housing choices, for single people to families with kids to older people. And on the concept of, I think that focusing on allowing for more middle housing can help address those issues. The plan before us allows significant density, particularly along corridors and in centers. Most of what's allowed in this plan has been allowed by zoning for decades, but it's only recently the market has started to build bigger buildings with more housing units. And generally, density along corridors makes a lot of sense. That's where transit is located. That's where people have the best access to amenities like retail. But I want to be sure that we, first of all, think about the concern along centers and corridors, the department building, that focusing all the density there will have negative effects, including parking congestion. I mean, there's ways we could address those issues, but it's a complaint I think we need to keep in mind. But also, if we focus all the density along corridors, I'm worried that it might result in having a more stratified Portland than we already have. If apartment buildings don't really accommodate the needs or the desires of families who have young kids, and if single-family houses become gradually unaffordable for most of us, and we have, of course, seen a huge price increase in single-family houses. I mean, my own house, according to Zillow, is worth $75,000 more than it was worth 3 years ago. I think that we need to make sure that there's housing that's available, particularly for families that might not be single-family houses. Eli Spivak, in particular, testified about the need for middle housing at one of the hearings. And I'm interested in what we can do in this plan, or maybe it's not in this plan, maybe it's work subsequent to the plan, to encourage small-scale housing, somewhat above the residential but not big apartment buildings within neighborhoods. Things like duplexes, fourplexes, townhouses, small courtyard-style apartments, and stacked flats could be great places for families as well, and affordable places for families. And those kinds of houses would be smaller than most families live in today, but they're much bigger than a typical studio or one-bedroom apartment. And I'm particularly thinking about making it possible to build these smaller but more affordable housing types in our most desirable neighborhoods, not in places where currently there's not the infrastructure. I mean, we've been criticized, rightly so, I think, for in the past, allowing for a lot of density in parts of East Portland where there aren't services for people. I think we should think about adding more density in places where the amenities do already exist. So what I'm looking forward to hearing from, and I rely heavily, of course, on you, the planning staff, what strategies we can use to encourage those smaller, more affordable housing types. Should we tweak the number of units allowed in some single-family zones? Should we allow slightly higher heights in single-family zones to better accommodate flexes and townhouses? Should we change requirements for driveways and garages? Ask you to put on your creative thinking caps. And I'm also interested in, is it possible, does it make sense in some places to reduce the level of density we're allowing in corridors in exchange for somewhat more allowances for smaller scale attached housing deeper within neighborhoods? I'm not saying that, I'm not saying we have to do that. I'm saying I think it's a question worth asking. So obviously, that I've got an interest in some of the other topics that we're addressing over the next several weeks, but I do have a particular interest in this middle housing question.
It's really helpful, and last week we had a charrette with the residential infill project, well attended. a lot of discussion of exactly those issues and how do we get there, how do we share the benefits and amenities of our inner neighborhoods with more people. So I think what we need to make sure we do is in the comp plan lay the structure so that we can get there, but in this other project that's already underway, we get the specifics down in that.
So I haven't heard the term middle housing before. It's been mentioned about 6 times so far. It reminds me of Middle Earth.
Maybe housing for hobbits is critical.
Yes, I shall be smiling for quite some time until it becomes part of the Portland lexicon and we all understand actually what we're talking about. So that's interesting. I wanted to go back to what the mayor said about the windfall profits that some of the properties were upzoning. Commissioner Saltzman, early in the process, talked about could we require some affordability in housing in return for that. Are there other things that we could do to make sure that the community benefits when the council makes its zoning choices? I don't know what kind of, you know, we hear about windfall profit tax on other ventures, so I think we should be looking into if we're going to be giving something. We certainly have measured 66 and the takings law and that we may have to pay for properties that we're downzoning. Is there a way to capture some of the windfall that might be coming to some property owners?
Well, I think just to tag on to Commissioner Fritz's comment, I guess I'm a little surprised that I see no discussion plan on the incentive zoning approach and making the very tough decisions about which bonuses we eliminate in order to focus like a laser on affordable housing creation, both in the central city, but also in the mixed use zones. So I want to see some, you know, I want some assurance that this is happening and it's got to happen by this council making some tough decisions. And so I don't see that anywhere. And I want to know where it's going to be.
Part of the reason you don't see it here is that that's part of the implementing code that we're working on. So we should be looking at the policies to make sure they're setting us up for that. But there's a wave of specific zoning code amendments that are still at the Planning Commission with that issue embedded in it.
We'll make sure that we put it in specifically in one of the next two.
I think it's time for us to be dealing with it, not the Planning Commission.
Okay.
I mean, if we're moving on a timeline of adopting something in May, it belongs here.
Right.
And the Planning Commission can catch up with us if they want.
So,
great. And then, you know, I share the mayor's interest in historic preservation. I think we heard some good testimony on that, and I do want to see us deal with that more aggressively. I guess I also am curious to learn more about sort of the pervasive downzoning that is part of this plan. I mean, it makes sense, I guess, to me to downzone on steep slopes and other places, but to be downzoning around light rail stops doesn't make sense to me. So it seems to me we should have... And there also is the takings issue involved in all that as well. So I think we need to know more about how pervasive downzoning is and do we need a process where people who don't want to be downzoned can come forward and say, we don't want to be downzoned, we want to keep our higher density zoning.
I have a process suggestion based on these points, and that is we may want to move employment land and industrial mapping out of February 2nd and focus February 2nd on mixed use and housing issues, because that's what the rest of that bullet list is all about. So it just might be good to be topically focused on housing density, incentive zoning, all these issues that have just been raised. That's at least a meeting, and trying to mix that up with employment zoning and industrial mapping at the same time is, I think, a bridge too far. So even if it involves shutter another work session, you know, it might be better to move that out.
So based on what I've heard from my colleagues, I guess I have two questions, just want to get clarification. Let's go to the last point Dan made about sharpening the incentive zoning proposal by taking out most of the other existing bonuses so that it incentivizes affordable housing primarily. That means that there's going to be a lot of other things we care about that aren't triggered by that program. So do we need to be thinking about putting those in the comp plan more generally as values? Are we, let's take eco-roofs for a second. That's the one that's on my mind. We currently give people a bonus, hype bonus, for an eco-roof. Rest of the country is now building eco-roofs into their basic building code because it's becoming more of a regular feature in development. So Do we do that separate and apart from the comp plan? Do we do that within the comp plan? Where's the line?
That proposal is working its way through the Planning Commission now, and that's what the zoning code amendment packages that are right behind this train essentially are intended to do on the specific question that is being contemplated to consider building the eco roof as an option within the basic code rather than a bonus.
So I think one thing that might be helpful for all that is as a part of the discussion that you were asking for at the NEST work session would be to take the list of existing bonuses and to go through them one by one and explain to you what we think happens with them. Either they become common practice, we don't need them anymore, we need to do some kind of requirement, or we need some kind of policy. If we don't want it as an incentive, we put it somewhere else.
I think that would be enormously helpful. And to Commissioner Fritz's point, I mean, the big, we've got two major transportation planning projects, obviously, and let's just take the Southwest Corridor. Are we thinking strategically about how we capture affordable housing through upzoning in that plan? Is that currently a dynamic part of our thinking? Because we sort of lost that opportunity with the new light rail, and I don't want us to lose it on this particular. And if this is what TriMet's gonna, if it turns out this is the big bet that TriMet's gonna make in the next 10 years. And we're going to be deciding where stations go, and we're going to be creating, you know, more density. Are we being very clear that we're going to be looking for affordable housing opportunities along the way and linking any kind of increase in height to requirements to provide affordable housing?
There are policies in the housing chapter and in the a few other chapters that talk about that relationship to elevate the importance of affordable housing in conjunction with big infrastructure projects like that. So we can certainly look at the language of that. There is a policy basis in there. The map does, the existing land use map in the Southwest Corridor does allow significant density already. And we have made some adjustments to that strategically to increase opportunities in the general area of stations. It's likely that once the station locations become final, we'll take another look at that again. But we've done kind of an intermediate step of making a number of adjustments. But the base zoning already in place does allow quite a bit.
Well, Commissioner, I have been interested in the West Portland Town Center area, Barber Capital, I-5. And there's really no changes yet. And I've been assured that should the high-speed transit project develop more, that we will definitely go back and look at those opportunities then. So my impression is that there's been minor changes along Barber in particular, and that there's definitely scope for doing more in the next 5 to 10 years.
But again, the corridor already allows 4 and 5 story, even 6 in some cases, mixed-use buildings throughout most of it. So it's a matter of fine-tuning the location and some of the there may be opportunities for additional multifamily at some of those hubs that once we locate them, we can go back and look at.
I suppose that, I mean, would it be completely off the table to talk about downzoning now to allow height bonuses later for affordable housing? We aren't? Darn. I thought we probably weren't.
As you used to say on the old maps, here there be dragons. But I want to flag this issue. Unfortunately, a meeting I didn't get to have yesterday because the federal government was shut down, but that I think that you and I together ought to try to have soon is to meet with the FTA about... on. And again, I want to praise the good. There's been a great deal of good work done between the BPS staff and the agencies that we have to coordinate with for this plan to actually work. But I think there's some more work to do and some more rigor to bolt down here in the intergovernmental effort between the city and TriMet and between the city and the school districts. We had a very good meeting with the David Douglas School District leadership. I think if you look back at the previous comp plan, you know, again, plenty of credit for good work done, but there's some areas where I think we have to admit that the community with all these different governments trying to work together fell a little short. One is it's taken huge pressure from the community and from Commissioner Novick for TriMet to prioritize the 122nd Avenue corridor, despite the fact that, you know, a whole lot of people need a whole lot better transit service there north-south. And we've already zoned it for fairly dense development, quite a bit of which has happened. So we need to make sure, again, that in these corridors and maybe with the next streetcar corridor or two, we've got it figured out in this plan what upside people get and when they get it. And then secondly, with school districts, 250,000 more people is a lot more kids. Some of the districts have capacity, some don't. David Douglas in particular doesn't have much capacity. They've got a little bit of land. So the level of coordination between what we're planning for and what those implementing agencies that we don't govern plan for is really important, again, as to whether people 30 years from now say, wow, they really got it right, or how did they miss that? I think we all know which comment we want said.
Just final comment from me on this, and I know you have an agenda you want to get through this morning. The federal government now looks at housing and transportation together. And there's a ton of discretionary acts that we have to act on for the Southwest Corridor plan to be successful. We may have to move utilities. We may have to, move roads. We may have to invest in infrastructure. It's a ton of things. So I'm heartened that we've got some policy language, but based on my history in the council, unless we have some numeric goals, we're not going to get there. And I think we have to be extremely intentional about what we want it to look like, what the mix. With any luck, we'll have a new tool in our kit after this short session, which will give us the opportunity to boost at least 20% of the housing or whatever the agreed upon number in any new development. But I think we have to have some clear guidelines, and I think it has to be hammered out by the Housing Bureau, by planning and others, and PDC. And then I think we have to have a conversation with TriMet and our partners to say, this is what's required. So how do we all get there? They sometimes have dirt. They've been great partners on dirt they had on Interstate, where they created something wonderful. But I just, unless we have some goals and some numbers, I think we're at risk of losing that battle. And it's such a huge upside if we get it right.
I think when we bring to you the PAL division specific work, I think that'll really be come to light there. Part of that is looking at how much of the affordability issue is going to be really related to any kind of BRT there, and how much is just the market, and what are the tools we have that have really nothing or very little we can do in the comp plan, but a whole bucket of other tools around financial incentives and zoning and other issues. So go there. I did have one quick follow-up question for you, Commissioner Salzman, and that is, you mentioned that you want to zoom ahead a little bit on the bonus and incentive zoning, and so I'd like to either talk now or probably offline about how you see that working with the work that's going on at the commission and that they're getting close to final. I want to make sure that we're either going with that process or we're going to put it directly into the comp plan now, and so I'd like to talk about that sometime.
Okay. Well, I just think we need to have focus here at this council on these issues. And we really, since very early on, we really haven't had any discussions about it, and it's sort of out there, and it's just time to bring it home.
Good. Okay.
I would just mention in response to the Southwest Corridor discussion that I believe you have an agenda item coming up in the next week or two to renew the intergovernmental agreement of the partners involved with that. So that's another opportunity for you to make some statements along the lines of what you just said.
We'll just move on, if that's okay now, to public involvement policies. And this is sort of a base, for really the rest of the document in terms of how have we done what we've done so far, what kind of community engagement have we done, and are there any tweaks you want to make to that?
I'm going to do a quick intro. Chapter 2 is the public involvement policy chapter, and one thing I want to just note to segue to what Deborah's going to talk about is that Chapter 2 was written as we were carrying out public involvement for this plan over the last 5 years, and so much of what's in Chapter 2 is generated by that public involvement and through the lessons learned there. A few highlights from that. The policies in the policy document were initially crafted in collaboration with, we had 8 different policy advisory groups that helped us draft those. They met over 12 months in 2012 and 13. There were over 150 community members involved in those advisory committees. This is before the Planning and Sustainability Commission took on the plan. We also did surveys where over 13,000 people participated in surveys that informed those policy documents, and that was back in around 2010 through 12. BPS staff have been meeting with large numbers of groups through what we call hosted presentations, where we go to a meeting that somebody else is hosting and present about the comp plan or participate in a workshop or a discussion. We've logged over 1,350 of those kind of meetings over the last 4 or 5 years, and we write down how many people are at each of those meetings, and that adds up right now to over 20,000 people that we've talked to directly about the comp plan. Around half of those meetings were with neighborhood association boards and land use committees. So I just want to point out that there's been a tremendous amount of collaborative work with a lot of different groups throughout the city. And of course, during that time, I've also been translating materials into multiple languages and reaching out to underrepresented communities and the organizations that represent them. And the other half of the meetings, a lot of them were with different constituents on interest issues or on groups that represent underrepresented communities. So with that lead-in about sort of public involvement in the comp plan, Deborah's going to talk about some of the choices.
Just one quick question. Were you able to do specific outreach to renters as part of the process?
We did work with the Community Alliance of Tenants to do some very targeted outreach to renters because we knew that was one of the groups that typically aren't involved in our public processes, so we made some extra efforts. So good morning, I'm Deborah Stein. We're going to start with community involvement, Chapter 2, as your first tier or big picture issue to tackle. We've selected this for you to start for your discussion, partly because it's so foundational to the whole plan and foundational to the city's ongoing practices about community involvement related to land use that's required by state law. But secondly, we're starting with this big picture topic because you have heard a lot of testimony about it. So we wanted to thank you. All right, let's try this. So Chapter 2, Community Involvement, builds on Portland's very strong and well-regarded legacy of neighborhood-based involvement. But the chapter pairs that ongoing and historical commitment with a set of new commitments that are grounded in the city's equity framework and the PIAC, or Public Involvement Advisory Council, principles about public involvement. So the big shifts that you see in our Chapter 2 of the Comprehensive Plan, the shifts from the 1980 citizen involvement chapter are these. One is that we're proposing to expand engagement with underserved and underrepresented communities, and this includes renters, as Commissioner Novick just pointed out, communities of color, youth, immigrants, and refugees, and so forth. So there's much more of an emphasis in this new chapter than what we saw in our current 1980 comp plan. Secondly, the chapter really drives us to employ culturally appropriate approaches to outreach and engagement. And these are different than what we've employed in the past with our more neighborhood-based involvement. Thirdly, the chapter drives us to really build community capacity very broadly to support meaningful engagement. And this applies to all communities. We want to be doing more training as our work gets more complex and difficult to understand. We really need to build capacity for that engagement to be meaningful. And then lastly, this chapter drives us to particularly target efforts to reach those who will be potentially adversely affected by any decisions that are made, decisions related to planning investment. So it's an environmental justice model to say those who are most potentially affected need to be engaged. And those, again, are sometimes communities that are a little harder to reach, and we need to employ different practices. Now, the testimony you've heard, which is quite a bit about this chapter, there are a couple of major concerns you've been hearing. One is that there's a concern that the new policies may be changing or reducing, diminishing the role of neighborhood associations that have been recognized in the past. A second concern we've been hearing is about the term community and how we've used that term and how we have stopped using the term citizen. The original 1980 chapter is called citizen involvement, and we're now shifting that to community involvement. So we've heard some concerns about that change in verbiage. We also have been hearing concerns, including from PIAC, the Public Involvement Advisory Council, that we may be very ambitious in this chapter, and there's a concern that we may not be putting the resources behind implementing this chapter fully. So there's been testimony to say we need to be explicit in the chapter to say we need to commit the resources to carry out a meaningful community engagement. So with all of this in mind, I think that you have some general choices. You could be making some options. And one, of course, is that you could adopt the Planning and Sustainability Commission recommended policies as written. Second is you could modify the policies, and that could include anything from refining language to further recognize or emphasize the role of neighborhood associations and business associations, those that have been formally recognized in the past. You could consider adding policy that acknowledges the need for adequate resources to implement the recommended public involvement program. And you could also direct us to look again at the terms community and citizen and perhaps clarify the intent of the language choice. And then a third option would be instead to significantly shift away from the thrust of the policy as written and come up with a different emphasis. It'd be up to you. This is already reserved. But with that, I'm going to hand it over to you for discussion.
Well, I guess, with all due respect to those who think our public involvement or community involvement has been deficient, I think it's outstanding. So I'm not really sure what the controversy is here. I mean, sure, you hand it over to a bunch of public involvement or community involvement people who live and die on this stuff, and they're going to find deficiencies and say we need to do more. But, you know, I think you've done a great job. I think the Planning and Sustainability Commission language looks good, and if we want to add some minor tweaks, but certainly not start over again, any minor tweaks that will satisfy those who eat, live, and breathe community involvement issues, fine, but I don't think we need to spend a lot of time on this.
I want to just address this question about committing resources because, you know, frankly, when I think of the things that drive me in my public service, I would love to salt throughout the comp plan a commitment that we will fund them adequately. But I'm also hearing from Susan, you, and our legal team that we're then creating land use proceedings that complicate our budgeting process. So where is that line between, you know, we're sort of general commitments to adequately fund and the kinds of specific commitments that then sort of take our budget process and somehow commingle it with land use proceedings?
I'd really like to have Catherine Beaumont come to the meeting, one of the next sessions, and line that out for you so you can see what language really would click that kind of land use appeal and what wouldn't. And so that you, because this, you're exactly right. You could put that kind of language for environmental issues, for business development issues, for, you know, us for everything, really, that you're going to adequately fund it. On the other hand, there could be some issues that are more important than others, and you may want to look at it. And so we'll bring in Catherine, and you can have that discussion.
The just as a history, there was a policy in the initial staff recommendation along those lines, which was taken out on the advice of the city attorney for some of the reasons you mentioned, that it starts to sound like we're dictating the budget through the comp plan, and we don't want to do that. But the state does, in State Goal 1, does acknowledge that it's important to actually adequately fund your outreach. So there is a principle there that is in land use law.
So I'm really delighted that we're discussing this first. And as you said, it is statewide Goal 1, so it's important. When are we going to discuss my amendments? That's later or that's now?
I think the structure we've set up is now would be a great time to mention the general ideas behind your amendments, and then that will help daylight the the ideas you have, and then we can follow up on the specifics.
But this is the only time it's on the agenda.
Yeah. Correct.
Okay, I'm sorry. I thought you'd have handouts so that people knew what I'm thinking about.
No, sorry. The intent of this work session was not to get too much into the wordsmithing, but it would be, I think we have talked about your interest in making some wording adjustments in this area. So
to clarify,